This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Modern Dance with Helen Simoneau, Literature with David Lubin, and Film with Mary Dalton are all on the way this hour, but we begin with a trip to the theater. Frank Rich, formerly of the New York Times, wrote, "A vast, miraculous play, provocative, witty, and deeply upsetting, a searching and radical rethinking of American political drama." John Lehrer of the New Yorker, "A victory for theater, for the transforming power of the imagination to turn devastation into beauty." And the Philadelphia Inquirer, "An enormously impressive work of the imagination and intellect, a towering example of what theater stretched to its full potential can achieve." Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium Approaches, by Tony Kushner, stands on its own as one of America's truly great plays. What begins as a play about political climate, gay rights, and the HIV epidemic evolves into a story of human survival and the global community. The UNC School of the Arts brings this drama to the Triad through February 28th. Student actor Alex Bodine plays Prior Walter, a gay man with AIDS who experiences various heavenly visions throughout the play. When the play begins, he's dating Lewis Ironson. Alex is joined by Los Angeles-based UNCSA alumnus, freelance producer, and director Jeremy Skidmore.
It's always a little tricky to explain timeline-wise because it happened in two parts, the play. Tony Kushner wrote the first part. Very heavily and wonderfully shepherded and guided and developed. Had a number of different directors involved over the years, predominantly Oscar Eustace, who now runs the Public Theater in New York. But it was a very methodical process, and they were in no rush to get the first part ready for production. So by the time it was first done, this is Millennium Approaches, Part 1. I believe it was 1992, and it was originally done in San Francisco. And then it became such a powerful project, gathered very quick momentum, that he started writing Part 2 much more quickly than I think he intended and wanted to get Part 2 ready for production a lot faster than I think was originally planned. So Part 1 eventually made its way to New York, opened in New York, and then kind of went on tour, went to London, was touring around the United States, and then folded back into New York when Perestroika was ready for production as well. So it kind of had a 1992 to 94 series of openings all over the world, but predominantly in New York and London. But there were multiple because of the way that it was parsed out.
It really was post the initial explosion of awareness over HIV and AIDS issues, the initial neglect of the Reagan administration, when this starts to have the great success it did after the release. So it's already kind of a looking back on that period.
I think it's good to give like a framework for that period, definitely, because even though it started working on it and then first presented in 92. At that point, Bush Sr. was still president. So there really was this fear on the part of Democrats that there was going to be a Republican president forever. And that definitely is a part of the fear of the more liberal characters in Angels in America, this idea of just any sort of one-party dominance for such a length of time. And there's a lot of conversations in the play about how it was almost feeling like there was going to be the end of a two-party system and to some people. One party was so dominant over the other. I think the other thing that really helps people put it in time is that Philadelphia came out at the exact same time.
That's right. Yeah.
So
Philadelphia, the film starring Tom Hanks.
Yeah. So when you think about the impact that Philadelphia as a film had on the public in terms of tackling that subject matter, that was at the exact same time, essentially, that Angels in America was tackling the similar issues theatrically. And I feel like that helps a lot of people go, oh, right. You know, there were a lot of things that hadn't happened yet. You know, we were still afraid. We were still boxing people in, quarantining people away. There, of course, was no state at that point that had any sort of gay rights coverage, marriage aside. Like, there was no real laws at that time. You know, one of the things the plays talk about is that the gay community in general was having a really difficult time getting any sort of gay rights legislation through any level of government, whether it was city council, let alone state government, let alone federal government.
From the actor's studio, I'll throw it your way, Alex. I mean, and your role as Prior, what are you sensing, feeling, and delivering these lines, internalizing them, that might be different, or I guess just kind of signature for Kushner's work? Just talking about the language and the writing.
The language is fabulous in a way. And in an interview that he did for American Theater, he describes his play as having a degree of fabulousness. And I think that because of the scale of what these characters are facing, the language is so grand and big because, I don't know, I think commonplace everyday speech couldn't deal with the terrifying things that they're trying to face as people living in a world where there aren't any answers for very terrifying problems.
You bring that depth of perspective. And what are you drawing on to get you there?
Compassion. Compassion for pain and fear, because I think we all know that. But there's also hope and anger and need. And I think what I draw on to approach the play is a compassion for what the character is going through and allowing myself to live that fully.
Besides the then controversial subject matter, besides the use of language, what are some of the ways that the story is being told beyond the written word that tell the story in a way that captures your imagination, and what do you hope to achieve there?
I think any great play, as time goes on, ceases to become about the thing that it was necessarily created for and really starts to take on a universality that can be applied generation after generation after generation, right? You know, I have friends who were living in New York at the time of the AIDS epidemic began. They saw the original production of Angels in America when they were in their 20s, and then they saw another production in their 30s, and then they saw another production of it in their 40s. And not only is time changing, and not only is history changing, they're changing, right? So each time they've come back to the play, they've been a different person 10 years later, 10 years after that. So I feel like even though the play is very steeped, for example, in 1980s politics, very steeped, for example, in the fear of the unknown surrounding the AIDS epidemic, that when AIDS becomes curable, I think this play will still be relevant because then it will be about something else.
I don't necessarily think that the play even is about AIDS. I think lying deeper in that is a need for connection, a need for someone else to face, you know, the big bad monster.
You know, when you think about actors and directors and designers approaching a piece, I think it's important to understand the world from which the piece was born. And then I think it's also important to let that go. Mm. You know, I said during the first day of rehearsal, this is, and I'm not unique in this opinion, this is one of the greatest American plays ever written. But we also can't worship it, right? Because worship makes for boring theater, right? Mm. So we still have to question everything that Tony Kushner has written. We still have to dig underneath everything that the characters say. But we can also trust that all of the answers are in the play. So it's that wonderful balance of don't worship what we're working on, but you can also completely rely that it's going to be there for you. And I think it's then important for newer audiences, for the next generation of people coming to the play for the first time. You know, every single person in this cast was born in the 90s, right? So they can only intellectually understand the 80s. So why make it about that? Because they're never really going to know because that decade is gone. Mm. So then it becomes about, okay, what's similar to them now? What gets them fired up now in the same way that this play got people so fired up then?
Let's talk a little bit about the training that goes on within the context of this production. What were your goals setting out educationally with this production? What were your hopes? And then how, if at all, has it changed as it's gone along?
The pieces themselves, I believe, present completely different challenges. Millennium, to me, is much more actor-driven, language-driven. The magic and the fractured realities that the play presents happen largely in the second part. So when you get to the second part, Perestroika, is much more theatrical, and I feel like gives directors, designers a lot more room to play in terms of lighting and set and special effects and just crazy stuff that just fractures all sense of reality and time and space. So since we're just doing the first part, I feel like the first part, therefore, is actually a lot less director-driven. It's a lot less about director-designer and a lot more about the actor. So I feel like within a training program, it's a beautiful piece to tackle as an actor because it's all about the actor. And I feel like there are 26 scenes in the play, and each of those scenes are almost beautifully structured plays within themselves. They're almost all two people scenes, with some exceptions, and they all have their own beginning and a middle and an end. So if you're an actor in a training program learning to apply your craft, learning to apply actions and objectives, learning to pursue the things that you want, each of those scenes just by themselves are extraordinary opportunities to really see the musculature of that craft and see what works and doesn't work.
I've heard that it's tough to keep that thread of continuity from the actor's perspective. If you've got your little scene, you go away, and then you've got to come up and then pick up that momentum or that tempo in the next scene with a gap in between. But this play is just rife with that sort of challenge.
Yeah, it's actually very misleading because, you know, when people think about Angels in America who've seen it or read it or seen the HBO film, you know, you think about Pryor. And actually in Millennium, it's almost more Joe Pitt's story than it is Pryor's story. Over the two parts, it is very much Pryor's story. But Joe Pitt actually spends more time on stage in the first part than Pryor does. So it's very episodic. And there's no one character that has any more than three or four scenes per act. So there's a lot of downtime. It makes it very much easier to rehearse that way because you're not doing a King Lear where you've got the same actor being called all the time and you're really wearing that one actor out. This has an ebb and flow to it.
How do you coach that continuity then for the character coming back on after several minutes backstage?
You know, I find that that's really something that's hard to teach. That's where run-throughs become important, where the actor can then feel for the first time, okay, how much time do I have between scenes? And then really start thinking about for themselves how they're going to spend that time. You know, I imagine for shorter runs like this is going to be, it's only 2 weeks, I imagine that the cast will probably stay much more on the periphery of the stage, much more close to the entrances and exits, much more engaged in listening to everything that's happening and the temperature of the room. Whereas if it were running for a year, there would probably be a much greater comfort level of being able to just step in and turn something on and then step off and turn that thing off. But that's a muscle that you just have to practice. It's a really hard thing to teach. I don't envy them because, you know, some of these scenes are incredibly, as Alex was saying earlier, the stakes are so huge that it's very challenging to walk in from offstage having not been on stage for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes for some of these people and just land right into the fury of whatever the scene is.
I can't even imagine it.
It's like I ran cross country a bunch in high school and it's a lot like running a 5K. That's what I feel like at the end of doing a run of the show. And I stay on the periphery and I know a lot of my cohorts do and just breathe with the play as, you know, as I'm not on the scene. Just try to breathe with the life of the play because the play has its own through life that follows in between your scenes. That in, if you're breathing along with it, it'll all go together. Trying to, you know, stop halfway through a 5K and then get back running again is not something you'd want to do.
Jeremy Skidmore, Alex Bodine, thank you very much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
UNC School of the Arts student actor Alex Bodine and Los Angeles-based UNCSA alumnus, freelance producer and director Jeremy Skidmore. John Helpern of the New York Observer wrote, "Angels in America is the finest drama of our time, speaking to us of an entire era of life and death as no other play within memory. It ranks as nothing less than one of the greatest plays of the 20th century." Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium Approaches, the 1993 Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Tony Kushner, comes to Performance Place on the UNCSA campus, where it'll run through February 28th with matinee and evening performances. The play contains mature themes and content is not recommended for people under 18. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take a short break before returning with Dance, a new book by Wake Forest University's Charlotte C. Weber Professor of Art and former Rolling Stone reviewer David Lubin, and a behind-the-scenes peek at a couple of Oscar picks with Mary Dalton next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and author David Lubin is here to share his new book, Flags and Faces, The Visual Culture of America's First World War. David knows a thing or two about visual culture. He's the 2004 winner of the Smithsonian Institution's Charles Eldridge Prize for Outstanding Scholarship in American Art. And he'll join us about 10 minutes from now. But first, we're off to the dance. Montreal native, UNCSA alumna Helen Simoneau dance, that is. Helen Simoneau dance, celebrating its fifth year, is busy creating new works during their residency at UNC School of the Arts this week and next. Untitled Solo, Moonlight Parade, and The Task of Doing, a collaboration with composer Eric Schwartz. I began by asking Helen about her choreographic process.
The material is, so if I was writing text, it would be the words, the sentences. So for dance, it's phrase work. We explore different material, different ways of moving, movements basically, string them together, and in what we call phrases or phrase work.
What would one phrase be, for example?
I mean, a phrase could be a series of, you know, just as little as like maybe three steps. But it could also be, you know, I have a phrase that we're working with right now that's 4 minutes long. Now, what I'm going to do with that phrase is still unknown. You know, I might take that phrase and then chop it up into smaller pieces, or I might take that phrase and add a second person into it to make a duet out of that initial phrase.
Okay.
So sometimes I work that way. What I like to do is really begin with the movement material and with form. And then from there, something emerges. And it usually has to do with whatever, you know, is going on in my personal life. It somehow seems to find its way into the work in some way.
Eric Schwartz, the composer you're working with on this program, pretty creative guy, Eric. How's that collaboration gone for you? And talk a little bit about the music that will be paired with this.
It's really wonderful. Eric had a piece of music that was already existing he created a while back. And I, one day, just we were talking and that we should do something together. And I listened to some of his music and I just fell in love with this one piece. And so I started working with this one piece. And then it's a rather short piece. So I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to expand on this? So we talked about it and he was really into the idea. And so he created a whole other, basically the section that already was existing was the second movement. And so he created a first movement and a third movement to complete the work. So it's, the piece itself is about a half evening, 30 minutes or so. And one of the things that really attracts me to Eric's music is that it's very bold. It's saturated. It's potent. There's a very clear artistic vision in his work that I wanted to embrace as a way to maybe push me to be a little bit more bold in my choices.
And in full disclosure, I should point out that one of the musicians performing on this is my wife, Jackie Carrasco, who performs with Eric frequently in forecast music. Well, tell me a little bit more about how the story rolls out and The Task of Doing.
Well, I'm still working on the piece, so it is still unknown how it will unfold ultimately. But I do have one section that is pretty mapped out, and then the rest of the piece is not set to the music yet. While Eric was working on the composition and getting that recorded, I was working on the material, and we worked separately for a little bit, and then we talked. And so we're sort of at that place right now where I have all this material like I was talking about earlier. So I have more, this is sort of like making a film in a way, like I have more footage than I need at this point. And so I have to go in sort of like as a director and piece things together and edit it out material that's not really useful or doesn't necessarily support the whole arc of the piece. So how it unfolds is still unknown. It's something I'm looking forward to delving into. The dancers and I will be working for a month, and so we still have time to flesh it out, to develop the piece.
Wow, working on it for a month. The time schedule for orchestral musicians versus jazzers versus dancers. I mean, every discipline is so different. Mm-hmm. But the time frame for choreography and dance is really unique in that sense, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we've worked already for 3 weeks. And we have had rehearsals in New York. But the thing that's really, I find interesting about dance and also creating new works, which is really, you know, what I do, the score is within the dancers' bodies. So there's not a way that I can write the dance beforehand.
What are you referring to when you say score?
In the same way that you would have a musical score. So the document, you know, the map or the direction, sort of like in a play, it would be, you know, the actual text. But in dance, and especially in modern dance, because the vocabulary is not quite as codified, yeah, you can video the dance and you can write it down, but essentially, like, I can't make the dance without the people being in the room. That's just the way it works. So, that's the way it works for me. I can't go into a rehearsal and already know what it's going to be. Mm. And there's not a score or a text or, you know,
it's more like a roadmap then in that sense.
Yeah.
And how much of that is contingent upon just the variety of shapes and sizes of the dancers and the abilities of the dancers themselves?
Well, that's huge. That's huge. And that's something that it makes it really important who is invited into the process and who agrees to be part of the process. And I've been really fortunate to come across some dancers that are invested. They're invested at all different levels, and they are curious. And that's really important to me, that because we spend so much more time in rehearsal together than we do on stage, it's important that that process be valuable and meaningful to them. So it is very much a collaboration. And I have to be inspired, and they have to be inspired, and it's like a ball bouncing back and forth throughout the entire process. And that's when I find ease and I find pleasure in creating, is when there's like a constant flow of creativity.
Give me a sense of the piece.
The solo begins in a chair. I'm sitting in a chair, and I have this music that I'm using is a contemporary artist, but he works, his name is Bernard Adamus, and he works with, there's like a folk sound to his music, and it just really spoke to me. So that's one of the pieces that I'm working with. And the entire first section is very fast movement on the floor, and I'm having someone build like a fur coat for me. It's not real fur.
I understand.
So that I can dance that whole first section in this coat, which for me is significant because where I'm from and when I was growing up, every woman had a fur coat, no matter what place in society she was or what financial situation. Most women of a certain age had a fur coat. I just remember growing up, and whenever there would be a party, you know, everybody would put all their coats on the bed, and we, you know, as children would end up falling asleep in these, our grandmother's fur coats. And there's just something about that that's very nostalgic for me. So I thought I wanted to revisit that. So I'm having something made that resembles a fur coat that I'll be dancing in for at least the first part of the piece. And then from there, I think it just will unfold into maybe something a little bit more abstract.
Professional dancer, choreographer, and UNC School of the Arts alumna Helen Simoneau. Helen Simoneau Dance has expanded its UNCSA residency by 1 week and will be offering an additional show to its run at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem March 4th through the 6th. And on March 10th, the dance company, now in its fifth season, will perform at the Patricia McBride and Jean-Pierre Bonfou Center for Dance in Charlotte. All shows begin at 7:30, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When we return from this short little break, author David Lubin takes us on a journey of discovery about the visual culture surrounding World War I. And Mary Dalton takes us behind the scenes at this year's Oscars next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Thanks for sticking around. And you know what? I got a hunch you'll be glad you did, because my next guest is a pretty cool dude. David Lubin teaches history of art, film, and popular culture at Wake Forest University. When he was an undergrad himself, David studied filmmaking at the University of Southern California's School of Cinema while reviewing music for Rolling Stone. He got his PhD in American Studies at Yale, began lecturing at colleges, universities, and art museums throughout the U.S., Europe, China, and Australia. And during much of that time, he was cranking out a number of noteworthy books, like Act of Portrayal, Picture a Nation, and Titanic. David's always got a unique take on things. For example, Titanic was a cultural studies analysis of the blockbuster film. In his Shooting Kennedy, David examines the photographic portrayal of Jack and Jackie Kennedy from their public courtship in 1953 to the events of Dallas 10 years later. In David's new book, Flags and Faces, The Visual Culture of America's First World War, the Charlotte C. Weber Professor of Art chronicles public perceptions about World War I and how they were shaped in large part by American artists, photographers, and graphic designers. The book's second section, Fixing Faces, looks at the devastating facial injuries suffered by soldiers on the battlefield and their impact on their families back home. World War I-era sculptor Anna Coleman Ladd is featured in David's book. Using galvanized copper, Ladd created lifelike masks for soldiers horribly disfigured during trench warfare.
She was really a pretty average sculptor. She did sculptures for sort of society portraits of well-known actresses and wealthy women. She did fountain sculpture, pretty basic stuff. But at some point during World War I in 1917, she read a report of a British sculptor who was sculpting these, crafting these masks for men who had lost their faces during the war. For me, the important thing to remember is that Anna Coleman Ladd was just a citizen living in Boston. Her husband was a pediatrician at the Harvard Medical School, and a friend who was traveling from England told her about the work being done by the sculptor named Derwent Wood, who was crafting these galvanized copper masks for men who had been disfigured during the war. And when she read about that, she thought, I can do the same thing for soldiers over in France. And she applied to the American Red Cross and told them her idea and said, we should set up a studio in Paris to help men at the front or just coming off the front have kind of masks to enable them to reintegrate into society. So it was her concept using some techniques developed elsewhere, but then she really perfects them and opens up the studio on the left bank of Paris in, I think it was December 1917.
A woman in 1917 starting her own studio. How unusual was that for that time?
Well, it wasn't unusual for a woman of sort of advanced progressive ideas to go to Paris, which was a very liberated city, and to open up her own art studio if she had the wherewithal to do it. What was unique was to apply the art very specifically to addressing this huge problem, medical and psychological problem, encountered by these men who had lost their faces on the battlefield.
You chronicle the nature of warfare during World War I and the just the horrible impact it had on the soldiers who fought in a trench warfare.
Well, World War I was the first and really the only significant trench warfare in history. I mean, trenches had been used for hundreds, thousands of years, but during World War I, there were trenches that extended from the English Channel to the Swiss Alps, or about 500 miles of trenches, where the enemies on the Western Front were facing one another. I use that word facing advisedly, because no part of the man's body was more vulnerable than the face. If a person was hidden in a trench, most of the body was protected. But if he looked up over the trench, or certainly went over the trench in an attack, the first thing that was going to be exposed and the part of the body that couldn't be armored was the face. So therefore, thanks to flying shrapnel and explosions and sniper attacks, men were having their jaws sheared off, their noses blasted away, cheeks hollowed out. And this was the first time in history where men could have such severe damage done to their faces and not die of their wounds.
The scenes are described from the people who were there and living them. And one British nurse, I've seen survivors without faces, without eyes, without limbs, men almost disemboweled, men with hideous truncated stumps of bodies. And you have the images that go along with it.
Yeah, and what happened is these men would be rescued by nurses such as the one who you were just reading the quote from. They would be taken behind the lines to hospitals and patched up well enough that eventually they could return to the lines. But their fellow soldiers found them so repulsive. They smelled awful. They looked terrible. It was so bad for morale that the military officials said, we can't just let these people go back, patch them up, and throw them back into the front lines, even though that's what the First World War was ultimately all about, was having fodder for the other side to shoot. But they said, we need to do something to restore these faces so the men are presentable back in the trenches. And that's when plastic surgery, modern plastic surgery, came about. And various heroic surgeons were making huge strides in plastic surgery. But even at that, even after multiple operations, sometimes they just could not bring a man's face back to anything resembling what we think of as a human face.
The impact on the soldiers themselves, just psychologically, even after plastic surgery.
Well, for me, one of the most striking things I read was by this great surgeon, a New Zealand surgeon named Harold Gillies, who became like the great innovator of plastic surgery for these wounded men. But Gillies tells a story in his autobiography about how there was a man in the ward, a beautiful boy who had lost his face, and mirrors were forbidden in the ward. But at one point, this guy got hold of a little shaving glass and he saw himself in the mirror, and he was just so depressed by it that he just wouldn't come out. He wouldn't talk to anybody, and he spent the rest of his life as a recluse, just because of the sort of the mental damage, the psychological damage that his own self-image caused him.
I thought it was telling that Gillies, I mean, here he is a renowned plastic surgeon in his day, and he's quoted as having written that only the blind kept their spirits up.
I mean, I know, what a beautiful irony and sad irony.
Just so powerful. Well, I found it interesting how the veterans with horrible limb injuries at this time were, you know, eventually brought back into society, but those with facial injuries were really ostracized.
Somewhere I read a story about in the BBC in England in the 20s and 30s that there was a group of men that had all lost their faces during the war, and they were so sort of repulsive to the common everyday eye that they just stayed reclusively inside the BBC studios. So these men had beautiful voices, and all over the country, people were listening to them and hearing their golden tones and imagining them to be, you know, these very handsome people, just like David Ford is in reality.
Oh, thank you, David. Thank you.
but that they would have to have a lad, a carryout boy, you know, go out to the cornered restaurants to find something for them to eat because they didn't really want to go out on the street themselves and be seen.
It's hard to imagine that even the pioneering plastic surgeons back then, recognized as leaders in their work, they weren't getting the results they wanted, admittedly. And you write that these early efforts were pretty sad. Was that the early beginnings, or did it go earlier than that?
Well, plastic surgery was a 20th century invention. Maybe in the late 19th century there were examples of it, but people just didn't know how to graft skin onto skin, and so that bodies would accept, or the faces would accept, the new changes. And it was only really with World War I and men like Gillies that these techniques started to be developed. And they were developed out of necessity. Had there not been a war crushing the faces of so many men, the plastic surgery probably wouldn't have advanced at the rate that it did. So up to World War I, plastic surgery was seen as the province of charlatans, of people who weren't really serious doctors. And true doctors were pretty mocking of surgeons who claimed to be able to perform some kind of plastic surgery. But during World War I, there were so many examples of relative success by men like Gillies that a number of American surgeons who were over in France and England during the war, they observed Gillies firsthand, and they invited him to come on a lecture tour of the United States after the First World War. So in 1919, Harold Gillies made a trip all around the United States bringing lantern slides showing before and after cases of his surgeries. And that's really what got plastic surgery on the map in the United States.
Even the best results, though, at that time left, as were described in this article, I guess those skin grafts had a very waxy, kind of unnatural character to them. And eventually, prostheses became preferred to that look, at least for many of the soldiers.
Well, it was somebody working with Gillies, a man named Derwent Wood, who was in peacetime a sculptor, but was an officer during the war. And Gillies, working with Wood, came up with a plan for developing these metal prostheses that they could put on the faces during the course of surgery. And it was Anna Coleman Ladd in her studio that were able to develop even more effective and more convincing masks that the men could wear. But these masks were still they probably didn't have a very long shelf life. We don't know. There's no real record of what happened. What we do know is after World War I, the funds for these portrait mass studios dried up and they closed down. And so the men weren't able, in most cases, weren't able to get replacement masks or retouched masks. So the masks were, as I said, this galvanized metal that Anna Coleman Ladd and her colleagues would paint to try to make it look as lifelike, as fleshlike as possible. But after a certain amount of time, those masks would deteriorate, the oil paint would begin to wash off, and there was nobody there to restore them and refresh them. So it's kind of nightmarish to think what happened to these poor individuals after a period of time went by.
Well, I wanted to get at, I mean, the physical process, but also within herself, her ability to empathize with these soldiers and what the gravity of what they were going through to put them at ease was something that struck me. I mean, she was an exceptional woman in that sense.
Yes, she was. I think she had a tremendous sense of empathy. That was why she took this project on in the first place. But when she established the studio for portrait masks in Paris, she wanted to make sure that it was a really warm and inviting place where the soldiers who were being treated, who were coming there for the masks, could spend time, have drinks with one another, have conversation, really get to know each other, and Ladd would get to know them. Now, these were men whose faces were pretty repulsive by normal standards of the time, and she spent a lot of time with them, getting to know them and trying to understand what their characteristic facial gesture would have been, because that's what her goal was, is to devise a mask for a man. Of course, the mask was going to be a permanent expression. It was an unchanging expression. So what you had was what you were going to get. So her idea was by getting to know the men, she would ask if their families could send photographs so she knew what they looked like before they were wounded. She might ask to meet a sibling so that she could see from the sibling what the soldier looked like before his wounding. And then she would put these together and try to create the mask with the face and then come up with a skin tone that would be reasonably matched to the rest of his flesh.
How was the timing of masks and masking, the way it was perceived in society back then, how did that kind of make the bed for success of these sorts of masks in the way she Ladd was using them?
Well, that's a great question. I have to say that my theories on this are speculation. Traditionally, masks were seen as signs of immorality. If a person was wearing a mask, it was because they were a bank robber or a stick-up man or, you know, maybe a licentious libertine at a masked ball. But there was an aura of something wrong or immoral, indecent about a mask. My theory, my speculation is that around the time of World War I, masks took on a new meaning and a sort of more positive meaning. Certainly in the case of Anna Coleman Ladd and what we've been discussing here, masks had a therapeutic value. They enabled men who were badly wounded to reintegrate somewhat into society and get back to their families. But at the same time that this was happening in the medical sphere, it was also happening very much in the art world. Modern artists were fascinated with masks, and it became sort of a symbol of modernity. Oddly enough, the primitive face mask that people were seeing in ethnographic museums of African face masks, these were being injected into modern art by no one more so than Pablo Picasso in his great cubist works of the 1907-1908 period, like Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. He's using African face masks kind of as a symbol of something new, something different, something outrageous that was in opposition to the humdrum dullness and prosaic nature of bourgeois society. So for modern artists, for poets, for surrealists, for people who are interested in the unconscious and dreams and psychoanalysis, the mask became this kind of heavily laden symbol of modernity.
It's so interesting. The irony you point out that she was really obsessed with beauty over darkness, or for lack of a better way of putting that, and yet the masks go on to represent very different things in our modern society.
Yes. So, I don't think Anna Coleman Ladd in any way would have appreciated the kind of mask consciousness of Freud and Jung and Pablo Picasso. Oscar Wilde, who was such a great wit and clever person, who would say these contradictory, surprising things. I noticed at one point he said, "The first duty in life is to be as artificial as possible." What the second duty is, no one quite knows.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get at. But what else was going on at that time in our history that would lend, because that was a perception that was, he wasn't the only one who shared that, though.
No, and I mentioned Friedrich Nietzsche, and others were basically seeing that masks, in a sense, were more authentic and more real than the pretend face. I mean, because what Oscar Wilde was saying is, if you're wearing overtly a mask, everybody knows you're not telling the truth. Everybody knows you're deceptive. But if you don't wear a self-consciously announced mask, then you're just pretending to be a real person. But what you're really doing is having a mask anyway. I mean, so sort of the modernist perception is that everybody wears masks, that we all kind of hide from one another. We hide from ourselves. I mean, that's the whole concept of Freud, is that you're wearing a mask so that you can't see your own inner darkness, your own inner drives that would frighten you. So you have to wear these kind of masks. Oh, I'm an optimistic person. Oh, I'm a positive person. Oh, I love humanity. Oh, you know, I'm happily married. Oh, I love my children. I don't hate my mother. So Freud is saying we are just a complex of masks that we're wearing.
In the title of the lecture, you mentioned the modern beauty revolution. David, what is that?
Well, cultural historians have noticed for a long time that starting in the 1910s and the 1920s, attitudes toward the human body changed very much in the West, and people became very much fetishized about health and fitness. And, for example, suntanning became socially desirable in the 1920s. Before the 20s, before World War I actually, good people, decent people didn't have suntans because it make you look like you were a farmer if you had a suntan. You would look like a peasant. So white people wanted to have very white, pale skin. I've noticed, or many people noticed, that suntanning became popular after World War I. And I think partially maybe because all these men in the trenches were getting exposed to the sun, and suddenly a healthy tan looked like a virile thing rather than a sort of pansy thing. Beauty pageants started in the 1920s. The Miss America pageant, which is the first major beauty pageant, began in Atlantic City in 1921. Women started wearing makeup. Makeup became very socially acceptable for women in the 20s. Before World War I, if a woman wore makeup, she was regarded as somewhat questionable, somewhat shady or indecent. The only women who wore makeup were thought of as prostitutes or courtesans or actresses. But after World War I, it almost became morally imperative for a woman to wear makeup. If she went out of the house without wearing makeup in the morning, that was considered indecent. So it sort of strikes me that there is some transformation that's occurring, and I just kind of wonder, did it have any connection to the changes in the bodily look of men in the war? Is there somehow possibly that when people on the home front saw how men's faces were being restored as much as possible through prostheses and surgery, maybe people thought, well, I can do the same with my face. I wasn't wounded in the war, but I'm getting older or I'm getting dumpier, and maybe lipstick and mascara can help me. As I've been going around the country talking to different groups, including at medical schools, talking about masks, masking, and the sort of the history of plastic surgery, one of the things I've been noticing is people today, there's a huge fascination with masks. It wasn't simply in the early 20th century that there was a mask fascination, but I think it's very much part of our world today. And as I've been thinking, one of the things that occurs to me is, what is Facebook except a type of mask that one puts on to parade a certain identity for other people that's not, let's say, the core identity that you really feel, but it's the one that you want to put out there and be public. And social media in general, I think, encourage us to use masks or to proliferate our masks so that we have one mask for one media group and another mask for a different group. And we kind of try to be very agile in the way we switch masks around and have this whole repertoire of masks at our disposal. But the work that I'm dealing with suggests that there's almost a kind of neurosis that comes about from having too many masks of self that one has to constantly keep in play and try to make sure that one mask isn't canceling out another mask, or that one isn't being exposed and one's mask being pulled off. And so perhaps that's the fascination that we feel with the men who Anna Coleman Ladd was masking, because what a horrible thing they must have gone through to have their faces exposed that way before they were masked. And just the thought of wearing a mask and having it pulled off, the sort of, as could accidentally and very easily happen. So it's a very rich and, I think, unsettling topic.
Wake Forest University art professor David Lubin. David's new book, Flags and Faces, The Visual Culture of America's First World War, based on his 2008 Franklin D. Murphy lectures at the University of Kansas, is just out on University of California Press. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org. I'm David Ford. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. And Wake Forest University Professor of Communication and Film Studies, Mary Dalton, takes us behind the scenes right now for her take on a couple of Oscar contenders for Best Film.
With the Oscars coming up Sunday, it's really on my mind. One of the things I've loved in recent years is how they've expanded the number of Best Picture nominees, because some great independent films like Whiplash finally get into the mix, and I hope people will see that film, which is terrific. But there are two films in the mix that, well, they bug me. I have problems with both American Sniper and Selma, and they're on different poles ideologically. So you might kind of expect that I would have some issues with American Sniper, which seems to me a little bit like a Valentine to the NRA and pretty reductive. I'm surprised by that, too, because Clint Eastwood has made a couple of really interesting, complex films about World War II, both of them in 2006, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. You don't get that at all, though, in American Sniper. And one of my other problems with American Sniper is that there were places in the narrative where Eastwood could have had more depth, either through the brother character giving us a sort of competing narrative about the war, or the other Navy SEAL who began to question the mission. Another way the film is reductive is that it makes the recovery period after war, the PTSD that so many of our veterans have suffered from, seem fairly easily overcome. I also found myself, when watching American Sniper, thinking about the Ridley Scott film Black Hawk Down because of the way it marginalized the other. And by the other, in this context, I mean Iraqi soldiers and their families. And that's ironic, too, because in Letters from Iwo Jima, Clint Eastwood gives us this rich, fully fleshed out story focusing on Japanese soldiers. While I wasn't terribly surprised how American Sniper played out, given that it is this sort of hero story of Chris Kyle, I was surprised by my response to Selma. I'm deeply supportive of women directors and directors of color who are woefully underrepresented in Hollywood. And I also wanted to love this film because of the inestimable impact Martin Luther King Jr. has had on improving our culture. The film did not work very well for me, however. I like the production design. I like some of the performances and some of the individual scenes. But I really found the FBI report captions awkward. They didn't have any context in the film. I found them distracting. I also think that some of the things Ava DuVernay has said that she wants to accomplish with the film, like presenting the important roles played by some of the women in the civil rights movement, doesn't work as well as I would have liked. Also, the way that SNCC is characterized. Those things are a little problematic for me, in addition to the things that have been in the headlines about LBJ and his relationship with MLK and his role behind the scenes. I like the film. I think we should have more films about Martin Luther King Jr. and about the civil rights movement. This particular film just didn't work for me as well as I would have hoped. This puts me in a kind of awkward position, though, because it's not, in both cases, it's not really ideologically the poles that they represent that are the sole part of my problem with the films. It's the films themselves. I feel like American Sniper is a little sloppy at times. The story doesn't really move that well. There are a lot of missed opportunities. And I feel that Selma has a lot of promise. I think Ava DuVernay is going to have a great career ahead of her. But the film doesn't really work as a coherent piece for me. I particularly found distracting the references to contemporary issues at the end of the film. It felt forced. On the plus side, having so many films nominated for Best Picture is going to bring in more viewers. There is a lot more range. You can go for a classically well-crafted film like The Theory of Everything, a really innovative film like Birdman, or for my two personal favorites, the unprecedented film Boyhood and the surprisingly wonderful film Whiplash.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication and Film Studies, Mary Dalton. That's a little old segment we like to call Behind the Scenes. Next week on the show, it'll be film scholar, director, and producer Dale Pollack on the dystopian nature of recent sci-fi films. Why so dark? Why so angry? Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find links to all of our guests on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you'd like to send us suggestions for future shows, email us at triadarts@wfu.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at @TriadArtsSpeak, and in the meantime, we hope you'll tune in next week. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.